Okay, this is Jeff Spittler, March 17th, 2002, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 62, Bothwell and Drumglog. Okay, last week we covered the killing of Archbishop Sharp at Magus Moor, I'm not really sure how it's said, but I'll try to say it one way to be consistent. On the 3rd of May, 1679, we considered at some length arguments for and against the killing of the Archbishop. The one comment I received after class suggests I should have maybe more directly addressed the arguments from the Bible. And the arguments that I referred to, they did make reference to the Bible, but they didn't go so far as to quote chapter and verse. So I think in a minute we'll return to that for a few minutes. We also gave an introduction to Richard Cameron. Cameron had been licensed to preach in the spring of 1678. However, this was a probationary license. He was under the authority of those who had licensed him, including John Welsh. And he started to become a stench in their nostrils, the field preachers, when he insisted on preaching on the indulgence. But even though they didn't take the indulgence, they objected to him preaching on it. And they issued an indictment against him, and they charged him with exceeding the terms of the license by preaching without sufficient supervision and with preaching on the indulgence. He was twice called to submit to presbyterial discipline and instruction. In November and December 1678, and this despite the fact that it's all somewhat ironic that they were their complaint about the indulgence was that a free general assembly hadn't actually said it was sinful to take it, but then again one wonders how it could then be sinful to preach on it if no free general assembly had declared that. So in the spring of 1679, he traveled to Holland, where he fellowshipped with McWard and John Brown of Wamphray, two prominent exiled Scottish ministers. And or he was later ordained, but we'll come to that maybe next week, I guess. So, just to repeat on the Archbishop's death. First, did he deserve capital punishment? Yes. Okay, he was guilty of organizing persecution, torture, and execution of a number of Christians without any kind of just trial. I mean, these weren't Christians that were saved after they'd killed their husband or something like that. I mean, these were ones that were solely trying to live biblically and not, you know, they wouldn't listen to the intruded curates and so on. Like David, who sent Uriah the Hittite to his death, okay, 1 Samuel 11, and was accounted guilty. And is kind of guilty even by himself when he heard the story of from Nathan of the wealthy man stealing the poor man's sheep. He said, "As the Lord liveth, the man that hath done this thing shall surely die." Likewise, the receivers of stolen goods are accounted guilty. The larger catechism mentions this and gives Proverbs 29:24 as a proof text, which is, let's see. Whoever is a partner with a thief hates his own life. He swears to tell the truth but reveals nothing. So, you don't have to be the person actually going out and hanging someone or sticking him with a knife to be guilty of murder, right? In his case, in Sharp's case, he was guilty. Okay, but that doesn't really, in a sense, that's only part of the question. Some people, well, probably the Episcopalians of the day and so on would have said no, Sharp wasn't guilty at all. I mean, that, you know, you know, in a number, you know, the king and so on. Well, he was the king's representative. Sharp couldn't be killed without the king's permission, those sorts of things. Okay, but that's not really the argument. That it's not at the level where we might really be of too, have to, well, it's not at the level that we'll consider too seriously. But the argument for, first argument for doing it is that by extension it's a matter of self-defense. All right, and if we I know many of you are familiar with the biblical arguments for self-defense, but let me just quote one text, which is Exodus 22, 1-3, and is in this part which is dealing with theft, but it says, "If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. If the thief is found breaking in and he is struck so that he dies, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. If the sun is risen on him, there shall be guilt for his bloodshed." Okay, and I don't plan to do a complete exegesis, but at, you know, if at night you have a confront a burglar and you kill him, right? There would be no guilt for that, right? Okay. In other words, presumably, if there's somebody's there in the middle of the night, you don't know what they're, you know, whether they're simply there to steal something or they have other, other plans. And if a fray breaks out and the person's killed, well, that's their, that's the risk they took. And we could probably go to some other passages to, and even to sort of natural, sometimes even to natural law considerations about self-defense. But then you might make the case that, well, okay, but this wasn't really self-defense exactly. So we have the door locked there. We better better make sure we get that resolved, that settled. No, we don't. Otherwise, people think we don't want any visitors. Okay, and furthermore, right, you might argue this is really a judicial execution and that the sword is given into the hand of the civil magistrate, right? Romans 13:4. For he is the minister of God to thee for good, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. And then furthermore, Christians, of course, have explicit instructions not to take revenge, at least not to personally take revenge. If you turn to Romans 12, right, which is 14 to 21 in particular. Bless those who persecute. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. Do not be wise in your own opinion. Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath, for it is written, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay," says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And presumably, those Presbyterians who were in the field who disagreed with this, and they were numerous with the killing of Sharp, presumably took passages such as that to say, well, you know, it's not really our place to take vengeance. And again, as I said last week, I think that's in general, very, very helpful perspective. I mean, we should not at all be quick to execute justice in the way that these men did. It might be pointed out, and it was mentioned last week, that under special circumstances, justice might be dispensed in other ways. And there's some biblical examples of this. One is Phineas. And, you know, perhaps this is, it's obviously it's somewhat distant from their situation, but it is a situation where justice was dispensed in a rather rough fashion, and it was that fashion was approved by God. This is Numbers 25, 1 to 12. And now Israel remained in Acacia Grove, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Take all the leaders of the people and hang the offenders before the Lord out in the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel." Okay, so they did this, and there were people in the congregation weeping at the door of the tabernacle, and now when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he rose from... Oh, I'm sorry. I have to back up. I tried to skip ahead here. I skipped too far. And indeed, one of the children of Israel came and presented to his brethren a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses, in the sight of the congregation of the children of Israel, who were weeping at the door of the tabernacle meeting. So this guy comes in and just really flaunts exactly the problem that God is, is very angry with the Israelites about. And now when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose from among the congregation, took a javelin in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent and thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through her body. So the plague was stopped among the children of Israel, and those who died in the plague were 24,000. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned back my wrath from the children of Israel, because he was zealous with my zeal among them, so that I did not consume the children of Israel in my zeal. Therefore say, behold, I give to him my covenant of peace, and it shall be to him and his descendants after him a covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made atonement for the children of Israel. Okay, now, if we want to argue that Sharp's murder was special circumstances or killing was special circumstances, this was even more special circumstances, right? So I'm not saying that's, you know, a proof text that they should have gone out and done it, but merely merely shows that sometimes justice can be dispensed in other ways. Maybe a example more directly related to our case is in Judges 3, and this is the story of Ehud. Let's see, if we start with verse 12, and the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. And those, you know, you're all familiar with Judges, so you know we could be just about anywhere in the book. Sort of, you know, it really doesn't depend too much on what happened before or after. You know, this is just, and again, they started being wicked, you know. So the Lord strengthened Eglon, king of Moab, against Israel because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. Then he gathered to himself the people of Ammon and Amalek, went and defeated Israel, and took possession of the city of Palms. So the children of Israel served Eglon, king of Moab, 18 years. But when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for them. Okay. Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. By him the children of Israel sent tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now Ehud made himself a dagger. It was double-edged and a cubit in length, and fastened it under his clothes on his right thigh. So he brought the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now Eglon was a very fat man, and when he had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who had carried the tribute. But he himself turned back from the stone images that were at Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. He said, keep silence, and all who attended him went out from him. So Ehud came to him. Now he was sitting upstairs in his cool private chamber. Then Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. So he rose from his seat. Then Ehud reached from his left hand, took the dagger from his right thigh, and thrust it into his belly. Even the hilt went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw the dagger out of his belly, and his entrails came out. Okay, and then there's a long, there's a story of what happens afterwards. The servants think that he's asleep, and they don't want to bother him, and so on. So Ehud then goes and blows the trumpet. And the children of Israel went down with him from the mountains, and he led them. Then he said to them, follow me, for the Lord has delivered your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand. So they went down after him, seized the fords of the Jordan leading to Moab, and did not allow anyone to cross over. And at that time they killed about 10,000 men of Moab, all stout men of valor. Not a man escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest for 80 years. Yeah, so, I mean, there's clearly another example where justice is dispensed under special circumstances in a somewhat different way. We can certainly point to other examples. Jael pounding the stake through Sisera's head. Even in Israel, the avenger of blood, the victim's kin, would actually go execute the death sentence on the perpetrator. So the argument would be, and I'm not saying it's a sufficient or argument that necessarily wins the day here, but just, you know, trying to show what the situation was, that while it's maybe highly desirable and is indeed highly desirable for the civil magistrate to use a sword, there may be situations in which that can't be done and it's necessary to do it some other way. And then finally, we also mentioned the pragmatic argument. Right, that you could argue either that the persecution got worse because Sharp was killed, so he shouldn't have done it, or another way of looking at it is that if you're going to overthrow the government, you should have enough men to succeed. Right? And this is a, you know, sometimes we might want to say, oh no, we don't, Christian, you know, the pragmatic arguments are always wrong, but in terms of, say, just war theory, which has an analogy here, we would say, That one aspect of deciding whether to take an action is whether or not it has a reasonable chance of success. Right? And the reason is because if it doesn't, then you're probably just throwing away the lives of your soldiers. Right? And that, even though sometimes it is necessary to, quote, throw away the lives of soldiers, to do it for, you know, with no hope of return, just you know, you could argue against that from just the sort of biblical view of high view of life. So it shouldn't be thrown away unnecessarily. These arguments, you know, might also be answered. The persecution was already getting worse, and you know, maybe it wasn't worse because Sharpe was dead. And as to the number of men, as we will see, within about 6 weeks, the Covenanters raised a force of 8,000 men. Okay, so there was. That doesn't mean all 8,000, you know, agreed with this act, or you know, or anything in particular. But to say they couldn't succeed in sort of overthrowing the government, maybe was right, but. But in fact, they had a fairly sizable force. I mean, it wasn't just 25 guys who were gonna, you know, who had this kind of had these views. So, okay. So let's see. Picking up right after the execution, then, and I should say that the long aside on Richard Cameron last week was intended to point out that though he wasn't present in the flesh, he had a significant influence on what was happening, and he was intimately connected with some of the main, shall we say, players in the following event. So even though he was gone from the scene, when he returns, shortly sort of picks up where he's left off, and Robert Hamilton, in particular, was a friend of his, and was had stood with him when he went up again, when he went to these. Field Presbytery meetings, and now Robert Hamilton's going to make a more public statement. Sharpe's executioners fled to the west of Scotland, and when they arrived, Robert Hamilton decided that a more public statement about the government of Scotland needed to be made. And on the 29th of May, which is the anniversary holiday of Charles's restoration, Hamilton's followers rode into the village of Ruther Glen, which is just outside of Glasgow, and put out the bonfires that they were celebrating the restoration with. And they called up the local magistrates and had them follow them to the market cross. And there, Thomas Douglas, a minister who had, apparently come over to the Cameronian side, prayed and spoke. They sang a psalm. Hamilton read the Acts of Parliament and Privy Council that set forth Charles's supremacy over all causes, including ecclesiastical, and he publicly burned them. He then read out the Ruther Glen Declaration, and so read this to you, reenact history, so to speak. As the Lord had been pleased still to keep and preserve his interest in the land by the testimony of some faithful witnesses from the beginning, so in our days some have not been wanting, who through the greatest of hazards had added their testimonies to those who had gone before them, by suffering death, banishment, torturings, finings, forfeitures, imprisonments, etc., flowing from cruel and perfidious adversaries to the church and kingdom of our Lord Jesus Christ in the land. Therefore, we, owning the interest of Christ according to the word of the Lord in the national and solemn league and covenant, desire to add our testimony to the testimonies of the worthies that have gone before, though unworthy, yet hoping as true members of the Church of Christ in Scotland, and that against all things that have been done prejudicial to his interest from the beginning of the work of Reformation in Scotland, especially from the year 1648 to the year 1660, against the following acts, as the Act of Supremacy, the declaration whereby the covenants are condemned, the Act for Aversion of the Established Government of the Church, and for establishing a prelacy, and for outing of Christ's ministers, who could not conform thereto by an act rescissory of all acts of Parliament and assemblies for the establishment of the government of the Church of Scotland according to the word. As likewise that act of council at Glasgow, putting the act rescissory in execution, where at one time were violently cast out above 300 ministers without all legal procedures. Likewise the act appointing a holy anniversary day to be kept upon the 29th of May for giving thanks for the upsetting of an usurping power, destroying the interest of the church and the land, which is to set up the creature to be worshipped in the room of our great Redeemer, and to consent to the assuming of the power that is proper to the Lord alone, for the appointing of ordinances in his church, as particularly the government thereof, and the keeping of holy days, and all other sinful and unlawful acts emitted and executed by them. And for confirmation of this our testimony, we do hereby this day, being the 29th of May, 1679, publicly burn them at the cross of Glasgow, most justly. They didn't actually get to Glasgow, only to Ruther Glen. But obviously they were planning to go to Glasgow.
as they perfidiously and blasphemously had burnt our holy covenants through several cities of the covenanted kingdoms. We judge none will take exception at our not subscribing this our testimony, being so solemnly gone about, for we are ready always to do it, if judged necessary, with all the faithful suffering brethren in the land.
Okay. We'll see shortly that there'll be a shift and that some of the covenanters will actually completely reject the authority of Charles. It hasn't quite got there yet. It's pretty serious condemnation of the Charles's reign. Now, this of course incensed the government, as you might imagine. And before we go much further, we must now introduce John Graham of Claverhouse. I think we mentioned him before. Call him the Scourge of the Covenanters or the Despot's Champion. He'd served his country in France and Holland and had a reputation as being a, quote, dashing officer. He'd been commissioned by Charles in September of 1678 as the captain of a troop of horse, and he served in Dumfriesshire over the winter of 1678 and 1679. Hewison says that he had peculiar, if not unique, views of soldiering at home. Considering himself to be an armed high priest, commissioned to sacrifice the enemies of the crown as much for their own sake as for that of his employer, an Episcopal crusader inspired to do battle with dissent and cleanse away the gangrene likely to infect and destroy divine episcopacy. Thus he confessed to Queensberry, "For my own part, I look on myself as a cleanser. I may cure people of that plague of presbytery by conversing with them, but cannot be infected." He was the natural successor of Turner, right, and who acted on the principle that so as we serve our master honestly, it is no matter what we serve. Since Claverhouse declared, "In any service I have been in, I had never inquired farther in the laws than the orders of my superior officers." Okay, and Hewison says, "Even jovial Turner did not go so far as a hireling who, given a warrant, would shoot incontinently and sheathe his sword anywhere." Okay, besides the, you know, ordering his troops around, Claverhouse would often execute people summarily on the spot, himself personally, not even having, you know, not even ordering someone else to do it. In the spring of 1679, sometime he was appointed a sheriff depute, or I'll say sheriff deputy, of Dumfriesshire, stewartry of Kirkcudbright and Wigtonshire. And this is the region southwest Scotland where 50 years earlier Rutherford had preached in Anwath, and it's has long been a hotbed of first Presbyterianism and dissent, and then later just Presbyterianism, and then again dissent and conventicly. Claverhouse had apparently been recalled to Edinburgh. I say apparently, he was recalled somewhere, and on his return he took him near a conventicle in Galashiels. Oh, okay. And which he broke up, and then and that's down near the borders, and then he started taking a circuitous route back. He went to the town of Hamilton, not to be confused with Robert Hamilton, but the town of Hamilton, which is also near Glasgow. And there he captured John King, who was some sort of field preacher and had been a chaplain. In addition, he captured 14 suspected conventiclers, whom he dragged along with him, bound as beasts. That's how he dragged them. And this must have been right about the same time as the Rutherglen Declaration. So he came in pretty close. And Hamilton's about 5 miles from Rutherglen. So I'm pretty sure he must have gotten word of the activities of the 29th of May. Well, he carried... From there, he went south to the town of Strathaven. And he arrived at 6 a.m. on the 1st of June, which was a Sabbath. And he got word that there was going to be a large conventicle about 8 miles from there. And he had a force of, said to be, not more than 150 men. He charged forward with all his prisoners in tow, determined to break up the conventicle. And, let's see. So, keeping up with my general methodology, which when we get to the battle, I'll read you an account of it, rather than try to explain it all from scratch, as it were. The conventiclers, duly warned of his approach, converted the sacred meeting into a council of war and appointed Hamilton, apparently the only man of standing among them, to be their commander. He had no military qualifications. His first order showed want of tact. I, being called to command that day, gave out word that no quarter should be given. The preacher, Douglas, finally addressed the gathering and said, "You have got the theory, now for the practice." The Covenanters were marshaled and marched away singing psalms to a suitable arena at Drumclog, where the unarmed worshippers, men, women, and children, were massed above the combatants on dry, rising ground, partly surrounded by morasses impassable to horse. The scene of the encounter at Drumclog in Lanarkshire was the green slope of a ridge stretching between two tracts of moorland, overlooked at a distance of 2 miles by the verdant dune of Loudon Hill, which also gave its name to the fight. A rivulet on the western base of the declivity rendered the mead through which it ran spongy as the bog beyond it and impassable to troopers. Some field dikes afforded defensive works to the defenders. The command of Claverhouse consisted of not more than 150 men. The armed force under Hamilton probably numbered 50 men on horse and 200 infantry, some of whom carried swords and firearms, the rest being armed with homemade pikes, halberds, pitchforks, or other rustic weapons. The strength on either side has never been precisely ascertained. The officers acting under Hamilton were Haxton, John Balfour, okay, those are the two who had been present at Sharp's execution, Henry Hall of Hawhead, Robert Halfhead, Robert Fleming, John Loudon, John Brown, and William Cleland. Cleland, then a brilliant belligerent student at St. Salvatore's College, St. Andrews, some 18 years old, was a leader of the foot, and that day showed the same prowess which distinguished him as the commander of the Cameronian Regiment, which held Dunkeld in 1689. The redoubtable William Ferguson from Catelock, with a troop of men from the Vale of Cairn, was also there. Woe worth the day if the Whigs did not fight on this occasion. Claverhouse, leaving King and his other prisoners in the rear under a guard, reconnoitered their position before sending out a flag of truce. His demands were spurned. He had to attack. As the Covenanters moved into a defensive position, the whole host raised a cry to heaven in the words of Asaph to the melody of Martyrs, the 76th Psalm. In Judah's land, God is well known with his menacing finish. By him the spirit shall be cut off. Okay. That they stood under the bloody banner, a flag inscribed with vindictive threats, is a modern fiction already disposed of. Advanced parties answering each other's fusils across the morass and ditch separating combatants until Claverhouse extended some dismounted men in firing order and thus endeavored to make an impression on his well-posted foe. This destructive fusillade in time would have succeeded had not the Covenanters, realizing the disadvantage they suffered from their obsolete weapons, returned to the old method of warfare. Cleland, Dingwall, Ware on horse, and others on foot, joined by some gallant women, leaped the dike and ditch and made a wild rush through the harmless smoke upon the royal troops whose firing had been futile. This fierce onset of horsemen and Amazons, with sword, pike, and pitchfork at the push, was too much for the troopers who could not manage their horses in the bog. Fleming's ugly pike, long preserved at Stonehouse, ripped up the sorry horse of Claverhouse, which, as he implies, being infuriated, carried him a mile off the field so that his men were cowed and fled too. However explained, that was Claverhouse's explanation. His horse got mad and fled. The white plume of Seneff was the white feather at Drumclog. This white plume of Seneff was this continental battle that he had been in and supposedly behaved gallantly at. And the white feather, of course, is a, I guess a show of cowardice. He left 30 of his comrades dead on the moss and 12 fell at his side in the flight. Cowardice in him and his men is proved by the smallness of the number of the peasantry who fell, one slain and 5 mortally wounded. Had Claverhouse been a gallant soldier, he would have faced his pursuers on a fair field. Far otherwise, Sergeant James Nisbet boasts of slaying 7 troopers that day. The Covenanters recorded the prowess of Thomas Ware of Cummerhead, who captured a royal standard which was afterwards retaken, and who, though wounded, continued pursuing. According to Defoe, young Cleland actually seized the bridle of Claverhouse's horse and would have taken him had he been supported. William Dingwall was mortally wounded, his horse having fallen as he gallantly leaped the defenses to join Cleland's victorious foot. According to Russell, his associate in the slaying of the Archbishop, Dingwall, when dying, was so ravished with joy and his assurance of glory in heaven that his testimony often constrained sympathizers to visit his grave in Strathaven, where they sat and wept. The Covenanters killed were buried in local churchyards. Thomas Fleming and Loudon, John Morton and John Gebbie and Newmilns, Dingwall in Strathaven, James Thompson in Stonehouse, and Thomas Weir in Lesmahago. As Claverhouse galloped for life, his facetious prisoner cried after him to stay for the afternoon sermon. So, king, incidentally, was later recaptured and was executed, but we'll get to that later. Well, the victors did march on to Glasgow after resting overnight, but the city center had been barricaded. Well, what were they going to do? We'll find out in a minute. They retreated to their camp near the Bothwell Bridge over the River Clyde. Claverhouse reached Glasgow that night exhausted. He wrote a report that he had to finish in the morning. And of course, this is where he explained that his sorry horse had gotten injured and flew off, and so on. He ended with, "The country was flocking to them from all hands. This may be counted the beginning of the rebellion, in my opinion." Now, when the Privy Council read the report, they agreed. They ordered an army to the west, commanded by the Earl of Linlithgow. He had a force of 1,800 men. He decided to hold back at Stirling, and Lord Ross, who had barricaded Glasgow, left the city with his men and joined Linlithgow. The Privy Council also called up English reinforcements, which were led by the Duke of Monmouth. He was a natural son or a bastard of the king. And I was thinking he must be pretty young. He was about 30 then. He was born in 1649. And the English troops being called up from London would end up taking nearly 3 weeks to arrive. And then once the city was no longer barricaded, now we can see what the Covenanters were going to do, they went in and burned the mansions of Lauderdale and some of the prelates, I guess presumably including the Archbishop of Glasgow. Their force at this time fluctuated between 5,000 and 8,000 men. And peculiarly, they were split into four different factions. As Hewison says, each a menace to the other. And this is something that you actually, if you ever read this book, Old Mortality, by Sir Walter Scott, you get to this part, and they're all arguing with each other. And he doesn't have the... He doesn't have the factions right, he thinks, or he had, and there some of the ministers were indulged ministers when apparently there weren't any indulged ministers there. But still, in one sense, he probably captures the spirit of it, if not the facts. Let's see, the rebellious host was composed of four distinct classes, each a menace to the other, as Hewison says. The victors under Hamilton, with the ministers Cargill, Douglas, Kemp, were the uncompromising opponents of the existing political-ecclesiastical system, and avowing the tenets of Richard Cameron, were ready to adventure on action, damaging to malignant and indulged alike. The moderate Presbyterians, King and others, soon to be largely reinforced by Welsh and the men of Carrick, Gordon, and the Galloway outlaws, Ure of Shergarton and the Stirlingshire stalwarts and others, came into the camp willing to assist in restoring freedom, spiritual and civil. And while antagonistic to the indulgents, tolerated all the indulged who safeguarded Presbyterial principles. There was a more peaceable section still, little represented, however, held with Blackadder and Fraser of Bray, that the Lord called for testimony by suffering rather than outward deliverance. And there was a fourth, the worst class, the indifferent and ungodly associates who joined expecting loot and a chance to fight where there was no danger. Hewison goes on to describe, apparently one guy ran his, drove a pitchfork through a godly brother. So, he had to be executed. But because there was some rabble that was just along for the fight. So, okay. Well, I thought titled this at the beginning, said it would be Drumclog and Bothwell Bridge, but I think in the end we're going to have to leave on sort of the eve of the Bothwell Bridge battle. Cover that next week. That's right. You can have a nice week remembering the victory that the Covenanters won at Drumclog, and then next week we talk about Bothwell Bridge. Okay, are there any questions? Mr. Edmondson.
The same problem appears that they had back in those days. We have today probably in the worst because it seems that you have the two, well, in the New Testament, Bosnia, bearing with even coals of fire upon them, we spoke about pain or suffering. How? As you say, the idea of substance, this sense, there's such a wide variety of ideas of self-defense. Some say you can, some say you can't. Where would it actually get to be where there would be no disagreement if you could actually do it? What would actually have to happen?
Yeah. Well, I don't have an answer for you, but I mean, I think that's a good observation. I think we basically have a very similar problem today. I mean, you can imagine if there's some travesty in Stillwater of justice, you know, that there would be a certain number of people that would agree, and then, you know, there'd some would be willing to sort of overlook a that's a, you know, the body of Christ in Stillwater would be, you could easily imagine it being divided on whatever, really almost whatever the issue issue was. So I, in that respect, things, you know, aren't that different. So
seems to me the issue of abortion, and particularly folks that bomb abortion clinics, I mean, it seems to be a very parallel type of situation. If you really believe those are lives that are being murdered, what is your calling about the bill of protection? Certainly the civil magistrate here in America is on the side of protecting this supposed freedom of the mother or the choice of the mother.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had the protests, we've had the try to counsel, this thing's been with us now for quite a few years, and you know, after reading Alan Keating's article in the last Covenant of Witness, it's...
You ready to take action?
Well, I don't see any end of it. I see us at a stalemate. The status quo has been reached on both sides, and eventually either it'll die out or something will happen.
Yeah. Let me just start. I think in some respects the sort of the social situation is similar to that, you know, that, but I don't think the issues are the same. I mean, in fact, we still have the possibility to persuade other people and hold our own views and organize and try to change things. You know, we have in that sense, our situation is completely different from the people who took direct action.
Up until a point in this country, but I bet if you went over whatever the line is,
yeah,
your civil rights would be tread upon.
Yeah. Dr. Fisher.
Actually, I was going to just point out that the difference is that, well, I was going to possibly sort of follow up with exactly what he said. That with the abortion issue, you have an evil state doing what comes naturally to us, right? I mean, it shouldn't be surprising to us that the state does this. And we shouldn't, and it is, in fact, the judgment of God that does not restrain, that it's only his hand that restrains evil in the wicked. And it's his judgment when he lets it run rampant in the land. But I think, you know, people do start to agree. The more pressure you put them under, the more they start to agree. So Lisa pointed out that in Japan, the church is pretty much in agreement down there. That what's left of it, that they've got, you know, it's they're fighting for their lives. And so there is, you do get unity at some point, though.
Well, you've got to wait till next week to see. I mean, these are Presbyterians, after all.
Okay, never.
They're looking down the barrel of a gun, and they're still arguing about what they're going to do. So, but it only holds up to a point. So.
The fact that what do you get when you put four Presbyterians in a room together?
Right. Okay, well, on that cheery note, I guess we'll stop.